It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the iconic recycling triangle on the bottom of plastic goods is a worldwide standard and began here in Wisconsin. We'll find out about the Sauk City woman behind the modern recycling system. First, the Congressional Budget Office released its score of the House Republicans' American Health Care Act last week. If it passes, the legislation would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. Recently, its impact was studied by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. The group found that the GOP's plan could have a significant negative impact on Wisconsinites, especially if they rely on Medicaid or live in rural parts of the state. John Peacock is with us now to talk about the council's report. He's the research director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we saw last week the Congressional Budget Office score on the revised version of this Republican health care plan. What are your thoughts, or what were your reactions when you saw that?
Well, it showed that the changes that were made as the bill went along in the House of Representatives didn't improve it any. In fact, from our perspective, made it quite a bit worse. But in terms of the total number of uninsured, it's basically the same as they predicted before. Currently, they're saying 23 million more people would be uninsured after 10 years, and 14 million more in 2018.
And what do you see in particular happening in Wisconsin? What would be your biggest concern if this became law?
Well, our biggest concern is a long-term concern, and that's the effect on the Medicaid program in Wisconsin, which serves 1.2 million people, including 500,000 children, people with disabilities, seniors in nursing homes. The bill would chip away at Medicaid funding over the years and jeopardize the coverage of those 1.2 million people.
Yeah, spell that out for us a little more. How would that change over time? You said this is the big long-term concern you have.
The bill will reduce Medicaid funding by 25%, and it will especially hurt states that have expanded Medicaid coverage more than we have. But in Wisconsin, it's projected to cut $1 billion over the next 10 years. Our fear, though, is that that's only a start, because the bill changes the fundamental structure of Medicaid. It would no longer be a guaranteed partnership between the state and the federal government, where when the state sees that it has additional needs and costs, like trying to address the opioid epidemic, the federal government would no longer match additional state funding and over time would ratchet down the funding. And our fear of that is not so much that $1 billion over 10 years would be bad enough, but it's that once the structure of it is changed, Congress will keep going to the well using that mechanism to come up with savings. And the Trump budget demonstrates that, because he uses that mechanism to cut way more than what Congress proposed. His budget that we saw introduced last week would actually cut Medicaid by 45% by 2026.
And you said that's the long-term worry. What about in the short term?
In the short term, actually, the biggest concern, because the Medicaid cuts would phase in, the biggest impact is potentially in the marketplace under Obamacare that serves 240,000 Wisconsinites who can get subsidized health insurance there. And that would change under the House plan by making premiums and out-of-pocket costs much higher for the vast majority of those 240,000 people, but particularly for people over the age of 50, for low-income people, and people in rural areas where healthcare costs are higher, because the Republican plan wouldn't provide more assistance to people who have more expensive coverage.
And that's a big part of your report, the impact on rural counties in Wisconsin. You write, I think that premiums may be higher in places where incomes are lower. Can you talk about the bind you see rural communities being in?
Yeah. So in rural communities have a higher percentage of people in Medicaid than the state average. So the Medicaid cuts are particularly problematic there. But they also have a significantly higher percentage of people than the rest of the state who are in that federally subsidized marketplace. And the reason for that, well, partly because incomes tend to be lower in rural areas but also because people in rural areas oftentimes work for small employers or are self-employed, don't have health insurance through their employer and rely on that marketplace. Plus, because health insurance premiums are higher in those areas under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, the subsidies are also much higher in those areas. But under the House plan, that would no longer be the case.
We're talking to John Peacock from Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about a new report on the potential impacts of the American Health Care Act, the Republican House health care plan here in Wisconsin. John, a worry, though, is we might see these changes, but under the current system, we're seeing problems. The Republicans are saying what we have now, the Affordable Care Act, is not sustainable in the long run anyway. So are we comparing two bad alternatives?
Well, I don't think so. I'm certainly not going to say the Affordable Care Act is perfect, but it has had a tremendously positive effect in increasing access to health care over the last couple of years. Well, from 2013 to 2015, the number of uninsured Americans fell by 20 million. In Wisconsin alone, the increase was almost 200,000. So there's been tremendous progress, but the House plan would reverse that and, in fact, would take us back and we'd have a higher uninsured rate than we had before Obamacare because of the changes to Medicaid. But there are some problems with the marketplace. There are some changes that are needed to stabilize it. But one of the biggest things, a cause of much of the problems right now, and the potential collapse of the marketplace, even if the House plan doesn't pass, is that the House has instigated a lawsuit a couple of years ago challenging some of the subsidies for marketplace coverage. And a judge ruled on their side and said that Congress has to explicitly appropriate that funding, which Congress refuses to do. So the subsidies that are extremely important to the operation of the marketplace are at great risk, and Congress and the president refuse to address that problem.
Is that something that you think might be driving insurers to get out of the marketplace?
Exactly, because it creates a huge risk. Those particular subsidies that may go away are used by 51% of the people in the marketplace in Wisconsin. Those subsidies average $1,000 per person, and without those, the cost for the insurers will go way up. Many people will drop out. Some of the healthier people in the marketplace will drop out. The marketplace won't work for a lot of insurers. Because of that, some insurers are dropping out. Others are significantly increasing their rates. And that's the main thing right now that's destabilizing the marketplace coverage.
That's part of a wider sense of uncertainty. We don't know what is going to end up coming out of this. Is that uncertainty itself a problem for continuing coverage?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. All of the uncertainty hanging over all of this because of the questions about what Congress is ultimately going to pass, the questions about whether there's going to be an individual mandate, the questions about whether these subsidies will exist. All of those things are causing insurers to decide that the risks are just too high to continue to participate in the marketplace. Yet that Congressional Budget Office report that came out last week said that if you put those things aside, that the Affordable Care Act is working and would maintain the very high level of additional insurance coverage that we've seen over the last year.
You mentioned the individual mandate, and that from the outset was a controversial part of the Affordable Care Act, I think it's fair to say. And a lot of people, and this argument's still coming up, why should younger, healthier people be forced or strongly nudged into getting insurance and participating in the pool if they don't see a need for it at this point?
Well, and they don't have to, but for insurance markets to really work in something short of a universal coverage approach to this, you need to have broad participation, and you need to have healthy people as well as sicker people participating in that insurance pool. And so it's a long-term bargain, like a lot of other things. Many of us pay for property taxes for schools at times that we aren't using them. We have to pay for insurance at times that we don't need it. Down the road, we're all going to be in situations where we need that insurance.
As we wrap up, setting the political realities, the political landscape aside for a moment, what would you like to see happen with the American healthcare system? Tweaks to the Affordable Care Act, big changes? What would be your dream scenario?
Well, the first thing is we really need to press Congress to keep their hands off Medicaid, not to change that. And the only reason that they're going after the Medicaid changes, I mean, that isn't something they talked about during the campaigns. President Trump promised to protect Medicaid, but they're going after it because they want to undo $600 billion worth of tax increases for the wealthy that were part of the Affordable Care Act. They want to pass a $600 billion tax cut, and the Medicaid cuts finance that. But we really need to protect the structure of Medicaid because, as the Trump budget illustrated, that once they open the door to cutting that, they're going to come back and do that repeatedly. But secondly, they do need to review the subsidies that are part of the Affordable Care Act marketplace and make those work more effectively for everyone. And there really should be bipartisan agreement on doing that because the marketplace is the most bipartisan centrist part of the law. It's what Romney pushed for in the healthcare reform bill in Massachusetts that was the model for the Affordable Care Act. And Republicans and Democrats ought to be able to come together and make modest adjustments to that to make it effective.
John, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
John Peacock is the research director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. He joined us to talk about the Republican American Healthcare Act and the impacts it could have on families here in the state, especially low-income Wisconsinites who rely on Medicaid. When was the last time you found yourself staring at the little triangle on the bottom of a plastic container to figure out how to recycle it? It may come as a surprise that the system of numbers, which is today a global recycling standard, originated here in Wisconsin. In a new children's book, our guest Elise Moser tells the story of Wisconsinite Millie Zanto, who kickstarted plastic recycling in the 70s after noticing tons of reusable garbage dumped into the overflowing landfill in her town, Sauk City. In this encore airing, writer Elise Moser joined me and Veronica Rickert to talk about her book on Millie Zanto. It's called What Millie Did, the Remarkable Pioneer of Plastics Recycling. Elise, welcome to Central Time.
Well, this is not someone that I had ever heard of and a story I'd never heard before. How did you find out about her?
I found out about her kind of by accident. I went to an Environmental Information Day in Sauk City, and somebody mentioned that the woman who invented the recycling symbol was from Sauk City. In fact, she, as you said, invented the system of numbers inside the triangle, but close enough. And I was kind of new to the area, and I thought, well, everyone must know this. I just don't know because I'm the new girl. But when I asked around, I found out that nobody knew, and I thought everybody should know.
And so you've told her story in a children's book. Why a children's book in particular?
Because my first thought really was kids should know a woman did this. I was surprised. First of all, it never occurred to me somebody had to invent that because I just never thought about it. But then I thought, you know, women's accomplishments are often not as visible as they should be, and especially in the area of science, technology. And this was a big thing. I thought boys and girls should grow up knowing women do these things.
And it sounds as though she got the little first germ of an idea on a trip to Japan. You write in the book that she was there as a volunteer sort of ambassador for the International Crane Foundation, which in itself sounds like a cool story. But what did she see in Japan?
She stepped out of the place where she was staying every morning, and there were little bundles on the curb. And every day the bundles were different. And she started to realize day after day that what she was seeing was little bundles of recyclable materials, but separated by type. And that's when she realized that it was recycling, and it made an impression on her.
So she started working on a project to recycle and come up with a system. And at some point along, of course, she had to buy an industrial grinder. Now, here's Millie. Here's her voice in a 2012 interview describing picking up this giant grinder from a factory in Chicago.
They just died laughing when they saw us. That made their day. Loading that plastic grinder in the back of the truck, it's weighed a ton. We were both so busy. When we got into it, we went all the way. I mean, we did everything.
That was 6 days a week.
Right. And then if we had a good March wind, it was 7 days a week, because I chased the stuff all the way up the highway as it blew away.
Incredible story there about purchasing that first grinder. Sounds like people were laughing at Millie and her friend. And it's a funny story, but it's also remarkable because there was a lot of sacrifice involved in what they did to get that grinder.
Yes.
What happened?
They needed $5,000 and they didn't have it. So Millie convinced her friend, who you heard in that clip, Jenny Ale, who still lives in now Prairie du Sac. They cashed in their life insurance policies to get the money. Millie later said, well, we knew we didn't need the money. We didn't need the life insurance right away, but we needed the money right away. And so they cashed it in.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Millie Zanto from Wisconsin, from Sauk City, and her pioneering efforts in plastics recycling here in the United States. We're talking to Elise Moser, who has a new book out about her, a children's book. And you got to meet Millie before she passed away, but not very long before she passed away.
Nope. It was a real amazing fluke. I had been looking for her and I couldn't find her because I realized later that people kind of disappear when they go into a nursing home. There are no traces anymore out in the world. And I found her by accident. I was going to visit another friend and she was there, and I knocked on her door and introduced myself and I said, can I come back one day and interview you? And she said, well, why don't we just do it right now? And I found out later that her illness was advancing, and that may have been her last lucid day.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And did she, at that point, have a sense of sort of the history and the magnitude of what she'd done, what she'd created?
I think she did. For a long time after she stopped being actively involved in the recycling business, she was invited to come visit communities all over the United States and much further afield, China, Mexico, to help other people set up their recycling systems. So she knew that what she had done had triggered the worldwide capacity to recycle plastics.
I think now we think of recycling, oh, it's just one of those household chores. It's like taking out the garbage or doing the dishes. Can you talk about, there's the numbers and the other things that she did, that she created, that are now just part of the background routine for us now?
Well, the main thing is the system of numbers. They're called resin codes. And so when we think of plastic, we think of it as if it's just one thing. We only have the one word for it in the vernacular. But in fact, plastics are many different kinds of things. Chemically, they're different from each other, and you can't melt them together, which was why nobody had been recycling plastics before Millie figured out an easy way to separate them. And so it's that system of numbers. I mean, Millie figured out an entire system. She figured out it has to be sustainable from a financial point of view. She convinced somebody to figure out how to manufacture things out of the recycled plastic. She figured out how to make the system work from one end to the other. But it was the numbers, the system of resin codes that made it possible globally.
And she also discovered that you couldn't create things like this, start a movement in a vacuum. It sounds like she partnered with schools and local businesses and got everybody sort of on board and tried not to step on toes. What was her relationship with the community like?
Well, this whole thing happened because she was so connected to her community, and she really activated the community around her to be engaged with this. When she first started, she knew she wanted to collect not only plastics, but also paper and aluminum. But she knew that there were Boy Scouts in Sauk City who were collecting newspapers for recycling, and so they would not collect newspapers in places where they were in competition with the kids. There were kids also who were collecting aluminum, and they collected enough to buy a microscope for their school. So Millie was careful. She was more interested in making the whole idea work than in succeeding in having, you know, the most.
And Millie passed away a couple years ago. You shared with us a picture you took of a bench that's in downtown Sauk City that commemorates her life and her work. Oh, we've got that picture, by the way, on the Central Times show page on WPR.org. Can you tell us about the quote that's inscribed on it? Waste is not waste until it is wasted.
Right. That was one of many pithy sayings Millie had. That was the root of her philosophy. You know, she grew up during the Depression. She grew up on a farm in Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl years. When she was a kid, they made or grew almost every single thing that they used or consumed. And so she understood that it's a waste if you throw something away. But just because it doesn't do what it was originally meant to do, if you can find a way to reuse it or recycle it, it's not wasted.
She sounds like an incredible person, and we're going to give Millie the last word. Here she is from that same interview in 2012, 2 years before she died.
My folks always said, use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without.
The voice of Millie Zanto. And Elise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Elise Moser, author of What Millie Did, The Remarkable Pioneer of Plastics Recycling. She spoke with me and Veronica back in August. First, here's a situation you might be familiar with. You go shopping for some clothes. You go from one store to another. You're the same person, the same size, but the clothing size that was too small over in store A is too big in store B. That might be because of something called vanity sizing, a practice that assigns smaller sizes to clothes to appeal to customers who want a boost from wearing that smaller size. In a world where being thinner is often seen as being attractive, especially for women, the smaller number on the tag might make some shoppers feel better about themselves. But it can also make shopping really difficult for people. Here's a clip from the show Inside Amy Schumer, where Schumer goes to a trendy retail store in search of a shirt.
Can I help you find something?
Do you have this in a larger size?
Have what in what?
This shirt in a larger size.
Have you checked under the table?
No.
Good luck.
No, these are even smaller.
Could you keep your voice down? You're scaring the thinner customers.
Oh, sorry. I just need a... Just this in a size 12.
Like a UK 12? Which is a US 8? Or like a Japanese 12, which is an American toddler 3.
Eliana Docterman is a culture writer for Time magazine in New York City. She wrote about her own experience shopping for clothes and about the history behind sizing. Her article, One Size Fits None, is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Eliana, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, lead us into how you decided to follow this issue.
Well, so we had been having conversations, my editors and I, for a long time about frustrations with shopping, how we seem to be one size in one pair of jeans and a completely different size in another pair of jeans. And the conversation sort of picked up, actually, when Amy Schumer was included in Glamour's issue of plus-size women embracing different body types. And she got into a back and forth with them where she said, this is great that you're doing this, but I'm a size 8 and that's not plus size. And so we started to talk about the lexicon that we use around sizing and the numbers around sizing and trying to figure out why there isn't just one standardized sizing across all of the U.S. And I began to look into it, and it turns out the reason is it's incredibly complicated to try to assign sizing to people. And so there's so many variety of body types, especially for women, and especially in the U.S., where we have so many different types of people and so many different types of bodies, that it's impossible to have just one universal sizing system that everyone can follow. So what you end up with is you might be a size 2 in one store and a size 8 in another.
Yeah, and on one hand, this is a frustrating nuisance for people shopping. And on the other hand, as you point out, this blurs into issues over things like body image and expectations of how women dress and what they look like. This is an interesting, annoying issue with some serious consequences, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does have some serious consequences. Part of the problem is vanity sizing. Just to give you a sense of how bad vanity sizing is, which is making the label on the piece of clothing with a smaller number, even though it might have been the same size, the same measurements as it was a few years ago. Twiggy wore a size 8 in 1967, and now somebody like Mindy Kaling has been open about being a size 8. So that's the difference. You know, Twiggy was a model who was known for being extremely thin. Size 8 used to be the smallest size available in the U.S. That's a size 00 today by the same measurements. So the sizes have been shrinking in order to appeal to women because they feel good when they're in a smaller size. But it also helps perpetuate this idea that smaller is better, which isn't necessarily the case.
And does it look like this is an intentional effort from people who design and market clothing, this vanity sizing?
Yes, absolutely. I spoke to people within the industry, professors at fashion schools, who talk about how there is still this idea within the fashion community that they are designing for a certain type of body type, and that body type is almost always very thin, white woman. So that is the body that they are designing for. And the fashion industry has had a hard time thinking about diversity in many different types of ways, in its advertisements, in the way that it designs clothing, in the people that it's marketing to. And so they've had a hard time embracing women who are curvier. So that's been a big problem for them, and I think that the transition's starting to happen. One of the people that I spoke to was Melissa McCarthy, who, along with being this movie star, had this experience where she was going on sets and they were having to Frankenstein clothes for her together because she couldn't find something that was flattering and that fit that she wanted to wear on screen. And, you know, there is a troop of people who just look for clothes for these stars to wear in movies, and they couldn't find anything. And so what she eventually did is she started making her own clothes, and then she launched her own clothing line. And she said, when I spoke to her, I don't understand why, you know, more designers don't launch clothing lines that include larger sizes, because, you know, 67% of American women wear a size 14 or above, and so there's a huge market there.
Let's take a caller. We've got Maddie on the line in central Wisconsin. Maddie, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Maybe just a little insight with my dealing with the fashion world over the years from the late 50s and 60s. And I was aware that there could be a size 12 in one store, but you go to the high end and a little more exclusive situation and you could be a size 2. And I kind of think that still holds true because I have some clothes that are size 6 and 2, and I would put myself between a 12 and a 14. Now I have items, I feel like taking that size tag and putting it on the outside of the garment. Oh, this is a size 2. I know I'm not a size 2, but in dealing with retailing years back, there would be women coming into a store. Oh, I'm a size 8. Where are the 8s? Well, I would kind of size her up a little bit and think, no, sweetie, I think you need a 12. But if you want an 8, take it to the fitting room. And then she'd come back and say, oh, but it doesn't fit. It's too tight. But it depends on the store you're going to and the price that you're paying.
Maddie, thanks. I want to get Eliana Doctorman from Time Magazine back in on this. I mean, that was back then. That's now. This is a big chore going from store to store. You take that clothing and the size you think is the right size for you, and who knows what you're going to get in the fitting room.
Right, and we looked at measurements across many different brands, many common brands that people shop for, and found, for example, that a size 6 pair of jeans can vary by as much as 6 inches in the waistband. And if you think about that, that's a tremendous amount. It would be impossible to tell if you were walking into a store you'd never been to before what size you could possibly be. So this has been an ongoing issue for a long time. And the fashion industry doesn't necessarily have the incentive to resolve it because they if you find the brand that you like, you'll stick with that brand and try shopping for that brand. The one thing that may change this, and this is beginning to change, is that people are starting more and more to order clothes online. And it's very frustrating when you order something online and it arrives and it doesn't fit you. And it's impossible to tell without trying it on first whether it's going to fit you or not. We think of that as a small burden to us because we can have free shipping and return it back. But the company that sent it to you has to pay for the shipping, pay to repackage it, pay to inspect the clothes. If the season is changed, maybe it goes on sale. So it's actually a very large cost to them. So they're finally starting to be motivated to try to figure out how to get you into clothes that fit you when you shop online.
Right. I imagine that the technology is there. We can drive a rover around on Mars. It seems like we could come up with a consistent sizing standard for clothing. Why hasn't that happened?
Right. So actually, as with many problems in America, Silicon Valley is trying to hack the problem. So in this case, there have been several startups, many of which I talked to and visited, who are trying to use basically big data to solve this problem. They look at your shopping history, they look at what fit you before, and then they try to pair you with a piece of clothing based not on the size of the clothing, but the actual measurement of the clothing. One of the very popular companies that's doing this is called TrueFit. And so TrueFit partners with many different stores and sites. Nordstrom's is one of them. And once you go on there, they will ask you, what is your favorite shirt? What brand is it? And what size is it? And based on that, they can tell you which shirt will fit in what size in a different brand.
Right. When I think about it, it seems ridiculous that we try to size people with a one number system because people are different heights, shapes, sizes, weights. They might be the same weight. The weights proportioned differently. Like, is it even possible to have a one number system that's going to be useful to people?
Right. So part of the problem is that when Americans and the government did try to create a universal sizing system, and they undertook this immense project where they measured thousands and thousands of women. And what they came up with was so many different types of measurements because women can be curvy in so many different ways that there was no real way to distill that into a system that would really work. What they came up with was size 8 through 38, and then they had letters tall, regular, small, and then symbols plus or minus. But all of that led to complications for any sort of clothing producer that's trying to create clothing. You know, that's so many different things that you have to create and order and know how much to order, and it's very unwieldy. So what ended up happening is that clothing manufacturers basically reverted back to, okay, we're doing this in a basic 2, 4, 6, 8, 12 sizing system.
We're talking to Aliana Docterman, culture writer at Time Magazine, looking at the history behind clothes sizing and why it can be so hard to find clothes that actually fit. And we want to hear from you on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you shop at stores that use this vanity sizing or mark larger clothes with smaller numbers? How do you think the fashion industry should set the size standards for clothes? Should the fashion industry be expected to contribute to its consumers' self-esteem? And do you have trouble finding clothes that fit? Let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Aliana Docterman. She's a culture writer for Time Magazine. She's talking to us now about some of the history behind vanity sizing in clothing and why sizes can vary so much, especially for women. And we want to know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you often find that the size of clothes at retail stores doesn't always match the way they fit? Do you ever feel like clothes aren't always made for you and your body type? If you shop online, we also want to hear from you. Tell us whether you find it easier or harder to get clothes that fit. Post your thoughts, see what other people have to say over on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to our callers now. Mary is with us in Racine. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell that I sew, and I made a wedding dress and two bridesmaids' dresses for three young women. And according to the pattern envelope, they were all supposedly the same size, but one was short, one was tall, one was medium, and they had all different shapes mixed in among them. So they were totally different.
Hmm.
And the only way to get through it was to fit each dress on each person separately and make the needed alterations. It was a nightmare, but that's That's how clothing is.
Don't leave us in suspense, Mary. Did it end up working out? Did you end up coming with dresses that fit everybody?
Yes, it worked out well.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Mary. Yeah, so there you go, Eliana, somebody who's making these clothes by hand, realizing you have to really tailor it to particular women.
Right, and that's sort of the interesting thing, is that as early as the 1940s and 50s, that was normal to either make your own clothes or tailor your clothes to fit you or have them tailored to fit you. And so this has been a problem really just in the last 50, 60 years, where we are buying off the rack and it's no longer the norm for women especially to have clothes tailored. Of course, men tend to have suits tailored. That's a service offered with buying the suit. But for whatever reason, that has not been a part of women's clothing.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Lauren in Marquette, Michigan. Lauren, hi.
Hi. I've been listening to this, and it's interesting because I've wondered. I'm old. I'm 67. And I've wondered for most of my life why women's clothes weren't sized the same as men's are. You know, when you want trousers, you get a waist in inches and a pant length in inches. When you want a shirt, you get a neck in inches, a sleeve length in inches, and a chest in inches. And I've heard you say for the last 10 or 15 minutes that women are also different.
Mm-hmm.
So why doesn't the industry just measure them?
Lauren, thanks so much for that call. I was a little confused. You said you're old, and then you said you're only 67. But why don't, I mean, if I go by pants, I have two numbers on it. Still, there's a lack of consistency sometimes, Eliana, but we can do all these things for men. There are shirts you can buy off the rack with those measurements, like you said. Why isn't there more of that for women?
So there are two reasons for that. The first of which is that women's bodies differ in a way that men's bodies don't differ. We have busts, we have hips, different size busts, different size hips, different size waists. So it's more complicated to make a dress for a woman than, say, a shirt for a man, and to size that up and down as opposed to a shirt for a man. The other reason is that in this 1958 study, where throughout the 40s, and then which culminated in actual this study in the 1950s, the government measured 15,000 women, and they measured everything from shoulder width to thigh girth. And what they concluded, they had all of these measurements, but one of the things that they found was that women did not like sharing their measurements with store clerks. And you can imagine why. It's similar to having to share your weight, of course. It's so loaded what your measurements are that for women who live in a world where they're judged on how they look all the time, it is a very loaded question to ask a woman what her weight is, let alone what her measurements are.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Eliana Doctorman with Time Magazine, talking about clothing sizes, how inconsistent they are, and why that is. We'll go back to our callers now. Michael is on the line in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I identify as a transsexual female. My body, I'm still biologically male, and I fall within the hip-to-waist ratio of a female, and I have a lot of experience sizing the subject of the clothing issue, and what I've decided would work is more of a unisex system where you give a waist measurement, a hip measurement, and a length measurement, where a female can go in and simply, or a male can go in and pick a pair of jeans or a size that simply fits according to measurements. For women, it would be, the difference would be slightly in whether it's a high rise or mid rise or low rise waist. That changes quite a bit. And with that said, math doesn't lie. I think it should go back to a system for both men and women where you have a waist measurement, a hip measurement, and a length measurement, and there's no guesswork. And I understand that women want to feel smaller or they're afraid to give sizes, but this, if you're ordering online or you're ordering where you can't put the clothing on, this is a true measuring type system where you would know exactly what you're getting.
Michael, thanks for sharing your experience and your idea. Would that be something that could work, men and women using the same, this is for pants we're talking now, specifically the same sizing system, Eliana?
So there are a couple of startups that do something like this. One of them is Latote, which only serves women right now, but I believe they're talking about expanding into different types of clothing for all different types of people. But what they do is they have you enter in your measurements, and it's a subscription service, and they will send you clothing each month depending on those measurements. So it's an idea sort of like that, where they are giving you clothes based on measurements as opposed to sizing. I think that near term, that is going to be the solution, is that you have a startup or a separate company that steps in and does the sizing, as opposed to the change in the fashion industry as a whole, because as I kind of mentioned earlier, the fashion industry has been very, very stuck in their ways in how they think about clothing, how they design clothing, and who they're designing clothing for. And I think it would be very hard for one company to step out and say, okay, this is the method that we're going to use to do this, when the other companies are increasingly saying, you're a size 4, you're a size 2, and flattering customers make them feel better. Studies show that people are more likely to feel happy and therefore purchase clothing if they feel smaller in it.
Michael, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Alex with us in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hi. So I've been listening for a while, and I actually heard something about this with Tim Gunn, as far as women who are plus size having a hard time finding clothes and something. I'm only 22 years old, and so when I was younger, I was about 4'8", and I weighed about 130 pounds. And being a 13-year-old girl and already having body dysmorphia problems and having a bad body image, when you are being forced to go into the women's section to find clothes, that just adds on to the types of problems that girls have. And so, especially not only for older women, the fashion industry should try to market clothing better for all types of younger women, because they have those problems starting early, and if they're just compounded by the fashion industry just continuing to make women forced to feel small. And
thank you so much, Alex, for sharing your experience. Eliana, briefly, your thoughts on that for girls too, she's saying.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. As she said, Tim Gunn has been very outspoken about this, about the lack of designers who are willing to design for different body types. And lots of, Beyonce has spoken about this, Melissa McCarthy has spoken about this. These are women who are considered some of the most beautiful women in the world. They're actresses and pop stars, and they have trouble finding clothing to fit their bodies. And part of the problem is also when you're going into a store and going into what's often a different section of the store to look for larger sizes, it's often dimly lit. You see a lot of people complaining on social media, especially about how it's dimly lit, how all of the mannequins are still thin. It makes you feel bad about your body. If you try to go shopping with people who are a different size than you, you have to go to a different part of the store than them. It's a very demoralizing experience, and I think especially for young girls.
That was Eliana Docterman, culture writer for Time Magazine in New York City. Thanks to her. Her piece on vanity sizing in the fashion industry is linked over on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can keep sharing your thoughts and experiences while you are over there. Have you encountered some of the things our guests or our callers were just talking about when it comes to the hunt for clothes that fit? Do you feel isolated, pushed aside because of your size at the clothing store? Is it hard to find stuff? Again, share that on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Memorial Day. We'll talk about the history of the holiday in just a little bit here on Central Time. And if the occasion has you in a historical frame of mind, let me throw this into the mix. Today is the anniversary of Wisconsin becoming a state back in 1848. A couple of fun facts. Wisconsin was the last state entirely east of the Mississippi River, to come into existence, the 30th state overall. I think I have that right. Our population at the time, just over 300,000 people, according to the 1850 census. We're up over 5.7 million today. And I have a mystery I'm hoping you can help me solve. Back, I think, in the 90s, I remember I learned the date, 1848, the year that Wisconsin became a state, from a beer bottle. The slogan was, I think this is right, 1848, born with the state. I went online today. I could not track down which Wisconsin beer that was. I thought it was Huber. Huber was founded in 1845, though, it looks like. Schlitz was formed in 1848. I didn't drink Schlitz in the 90s. So, beer aficionados with a long memory, let me know that I'm not just hallucinating this. What beer bottle had the logo 1848, born with the state on it? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page. More to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.